The following program contains sensitive subject matters for adult listeners. We ask that you use your own discretion for yourself and others who may be listening. Additionally, this program represents the views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. KCBX welcomes the comments of those with divergent views. Our phone number is 805-549-8855. It's 1 o'clock, time for Central Coast Voices. And welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and presented in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gullert Sargent. Fred Monroe is hosting the program from home today amid continuing concerns about the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Today, Fred and his guests will discuss a very serious topic. San Luis Obispo County has a significantly higher rate of suicide deaths than California overall. The County Suicide Prevention Council has just finished a draft plan to further develop the mental health tools to combat this ongoing mental health crisis. Joining Fred today are mental health professionals working to refine this plan and face this ongoing crisis with better prevention and intervention tools. They will have a frank discussion about suicide and how your input can contribute towards positive solutions. You're invited to listen and learn and participate in the conversation today. Call 805-549-8855 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. Now, let's join Fred Monroe and his guests. Over to you, Fred.
Hey, thank you, Brad. Glad to be with you today. We're going to talk about a topic that everybody should be paying attention to, and unfortunately, no one or a lot of people would like to avoid even thinking about. But it's a reality of life, and that is that suicide happens around us. It happens to people we know. It happens in environments that we are in and out of on a regular basis. And it is in most cases, a startling occurrence when it does happen. The suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, and it's a higher leading cause of death in San Luis Obispo County. Last month, the County of San Luis Obispo, in partnership with Suicide Prevention Council, did a draft suicide prevention plan and made it available to the public for review and comments. During the program today, we'll tell you how you can input your comments and review that plan and be part of that discussion. This is really a critical time in mental health because we're dealing with a lot of people who are challenged by both the isolation, frustration, personal and financial that comes about with our pandemic that we've been dealing with for over a year now, of course. The plan that the Suicide Prevention Council has put together is the result of years of collaboration among community members, government agencies, and private organizations to really take a look at how we can better address this concern. I suspect we will never conquer it completely, but things that we can do to make it less prevalent, to have intervention programs in place that help us understand what's going on and how to make sure that it is affecting us less severely in our society are important. My guests today are members of the Suicide Prevention Council, Alicia Hendry, and she is the Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the County of San Luis Obispo's Behavioral Health, Megan Boaz Alvarez, and she is a licensed marriage and family therapist and the Clinical Director for Transitions Mental Health Association. Thank you to both of you for joining us today. They're going to highlight the plan. This is a discussion that's important. I guess I need to start before I turn some of it over to my guests and remind our listeners, this is not a fun topic, but it's a topic that affects all of us in the world we live in. And sticking around for this program may come in handy and very helpful as you deal with and look at people in your life you care about. Please stick with us. It is not a fun topic, but it's a realistic part of our society. And I thank you all for joining us. Megan and Alicia, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm sure that the workload that you have had over the last year has not been not been as easy as it could be under a less demanding situation of a pandemic. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us here today.
I want to probably start with the what I would consider the proverbial question, and that is, do most people believe that this never affects anyone in their life until they get slapped in the face with the reality that it's happened with someone they know and care about, and it came out of left field?
We often hear that that is true, Fred, that, you know, within the behavioral health field, we talk amongst ourselves saying it really does affect almost everyone in all corners of society. But I think it is a common belief that it doesn't affect me until you, in your words, slaps you in the face with it. Yeah.
I think people do have a misconception that it's only certain people who might be at risk of suicide, people with, you know, severe mental health issues or severe drug and alcohol issues. And of course, what we know is that the reality is that anybody can be at risk of suicide. So I appreciated your invitation, Fred, for people to stick around and listen, even though it might be a hard subject matter to think about, because if we know a little bit more about what to look for and understand that our own friends or family might be at risk, then we might know how to help if that opportunity ever arises.
When the statistics that, the kind of the broad statistics that I referenced at the start of the program was that the 10th largest or 10th highest cause of death in the United States is suicide. It's in the state of California, I'm not quite sure, but in the San Luis County, it's higher up on the list of causes of death. That's a question that I'm going to probably be stuck with until I get an answer. So I'm going to ask it now. And that is, what is it that you're seeing that maybe in your mental health professional work tells you that there's things that go on in our community that make it a more prevalent issue here?
Well, from a coordinator position, from my position as a suicide prevention coordinator, Fred, I look at kind of those bigger picture elements and what goes on in San Luis Obispo County that might yield a larger rate or a higher rate of suicide. We are considered a rural county. And so with that comes different elements of availability of healthcare, for example, both physical and mental healthcare. We don't have the similar safety nets as maybe a larger city does. It has research hospitals. It has a lot of interns to be able to kind of build that net wider. So Megan, I'd also love to hear from you and your perspective as a clinician.
Sure. I mean, I think those are good points that you've made, Alicia, that we may not have as many resources as some other counties. We may also have a larger population of older adults. And I know that we're seeing some higher numbers in that demographic. So we may have people who statistically have a greater risk, and that could be a factor as well. It's hard to reconcile that, you know, we're a blue zone and one of, you know, the happier places to live, and that we still have this reality that we also have an elevated risk of suicide in our county. It's hard to hold both pieces of information, I think.
As you talked about a factor being an older population, more retired people here and things, what that brought to mind for me is that we are one of the states in the United States that does permit one to basically make a decision to end their own life from a medical reason if they're terminally ill. I don't want to necessarily equate that with suicide, but I don't know how you divide it. But it occurred to me as you were talking that maybe that kind of law that gives people some civil rights to make some personal decisions may give some people an opportunity to think that it's a more reasonable alternative to a problem. And I'm wondering if that's a tug of war between those two views at all.
You know, that question has come up in the past within the suicide prevention strategic, or excuse me, within the council, pardon me. And so, when it comes to the End of Life Act, you're working with a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a medical team. So that is slightly separate from the type of experience that we are working on towards our strategic plan.
Is what someone brings to the table for in their own life generally an impulse decision that we're looking at, or is it generally a long planned decision? Because I'm one of the things that's recurring in the material that I'm looking at that you provided with us to look at doing this program today was that an awful lot of people didn't realize that someone in their life was suicidal. Our presumption is that somebody gets a desperate inspiration that they can't solve something and makes that decision on very short order. That makes it hard to prevent if you can't see the clues in the person you're dealing with.
Sure. I think that's something that people wonder about and think about. You know, a small number of suicides are impulsive, as you've described, without a lot of warning. But the vast majority of folks who do in their own lives have probably been some observable signs, things that maybe friends or family, if they had known what to look for, might have been able to pick up on. And I kind of think of it as things getting to a point where they're unbearable. So there may have been a buildup of things over time. And it might seem sudden because one more event happens, but in reality for that person, there has been this buildup of stressors or emotional pain that at some point becomes unbearable. And that's when people may start to consider suicide as an option. And I think that's far more common.
Yeah, and to go off of what Megan said, when I first started working in this field, it was presented to me through the game of Jenga. So if you've ever played that wooden block game of Jenga and how you pull out a piece, right? And like it gets to the point where eventually you pull out one last piece and then your Jenga tower falls over. So if you can think about those precipitating events, maybe it is a mental health condition on top of trauma, on top of, you know, loss of something. So over time, it's that picking away at things where that tower eventually falls over, if that makes sense.
That's a very good analogy, because I think it's hard to visualize that last little bit of balance and stability and safety. As you said that, one of the things it occurred to me is we all look for the exit out of a troubling situation. And if you feel like you're in a situation where you're no longer seeing a safe door out of something, you start looking at unsafe alternatives. People don't jump off 5-story buildings. If the building's on fire and they're starting to burn, people do strange things like jump off 5-story buildings. And I suspect that's a non-professional's analogy, if you will, but it seems that those are kind of, When you are finding the least way out of a troubling situation is when you most need mental health professional support, but it's also probably a time at which you are feeling that no one can throw you a line.
Yeah, you know, psychological distress works that way. It's often, activates your fight or flight system. And if you're in that incredible amount of distress and feeling that much pain, sometimes it does seem like the only option in that fight or flight.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that they are welcome to call in to 805-549-8855. If you call in, you do not need to give your name, but one of our staff members at KCBX will take your information down in your question, and we will work with our guests to answer it on the air. You can also send a question to voices@kcbx.org. We're monitoring the email incoming throughout the program. If you have a rather long or elaborate question or concern that we can't answer on the air, both of my guests have agreed that we can forward your question or concern on to them by email, and they will gladly do what they can to respond. And also, with regard to the email, if you do not put your name at the bottom of the email, we would certainly not be able to know who you are or use your name. So this is an environment really where you could ask questions that maybe the stigma of worry about suicide has prevented you from asking, because if you call somebody by phone, they're going to maybe recognize your voice. If you email them or text them, they're going to know where it came from. Today, we can't solve everything instantly, of course, and I would not for a moment suggest that that's what my guests are here to do. But if there's something that you need to talk about and need to find a channel to get it addressed, we'll do our best to keep that confidential and you can be part of the discussion. There's a lot of misconceptions about this, and it goes back to by the way, I want to commend Transitions Mental Health. Stuck in my mind to this day is the comments that the simple word stigma that you had on billboards all over the county for a long, long time to try and end the stigma, because the stigma of mental health or mental illness is something that in and of itself gets in the way of people getting the help they need. One of the things that you had talked about with our preliminary information we received is that a lot of the public perceives people who are suicidal as being weak, as being unresourceful, as being selfish about their own interests. How do we address that kind of perception of this particular mental health issue?
I think that's a great question. Really, I think a little bit of education goes a long way. And, you know, you shared some of those statistics at the beginning of it being the 10th leading cause of death. It's the second leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 24. I think it's behind accidents only. As a parent and as a college instructor, that's a statistic that hits home and is alarming to me. So knowing that our kids, our students, our community members can be at risk, and significantly at risk, and that there are things that we can learn about that and recognize when somebody might be in trouble. Just a little bit of knowledge, I think, a little bit of knowledge for teachers, community members, coworkers who know what to look for. And they don't have to be the person who figures out what to do in that crisis situation. They only have to be the person who says, "Hey, are you okay?" And we have found that simple question, just checking in with somebody and acknowledging that they see something, can make all the difference.
I want you to back up for a second. Please state again what you did about the statistic with regard to young people and suicide. In my mind, it's like, make sure you say it very slowly and distinctly. I think everyone needs to hear that. It's alarming.
It is alarming. I would agree. It's the second leading cause of death for individuals aged 10 to 24. So that captures our college student population, most of our student population.
And in some cases also like up to 34 too, Megan. So we're really, it's increasing.
And I think what speaks to me about that is we know, Alicia and I know, suicide is preventable. Suicide is preventable. If we look at suicide as a public health issue and compare it to other public issues like wearing your seatbelt, where we've done these safety campaigns and really raised awareness, we have seen a significant drop in the rate of death from something that's been targeted through a public health lens. And so I think that's kind of part of the mission, is to look at suicide as a public health issue, not look at it as a mental health issue. Mm-hmm. But as a health issue that warrants general knowledge and attention. And with a little bit of that, I think we really could make an impact on the number of people we lose this way.
And I don't want this to sound argumentative, but it might be. How can you consider something preventable that people oftentimes decide to do within the silence and the isolation of their own life?
Well,
I'd like to believe it's preventable and not disagree with you on that. I guess I need a further explanation.
Right. And I don't think there's a 100% this or that in this situation, Fred, but there are things that we can do that we know through interviews with suicide attempt survivors, for example, who have attempted suicide, maybe through jumping off of a bridge, for example, like we know happens in San Francisco. So we have interviewed survivors who, you know, did not die through their attempt by jumping off the bridge, and then saying, you know, I didn't really want to die. And I realized that right after I had jumped off. Okay, so now what are we doing? They're building nets around the bridge. So that is one example of preventing that death, right? And we know with naloxone, for example, if more people have access to support to reverse an opioid overdose, whether it is accidental or intentional, that is a way to prevent a death. So there are ways in which we can prevent it and then get those individuals linked to resources, to a team that's going to support them through whatever it is that brought them there that day, and then ideally get on that road to recovery and, you know, get into that life where they can thrive in. But as you know, just to reinforce also what Megan's been saying this whole time as well, is education.
Right. Just a little bit of knowledge. And I have to add to what Alicia said and share that most people who have a suicidal crisis will never have another one. And so that means if somebody who knows a little bit is there at the right time and can offer some help or support, or if more people in our community know what's available for support and they get help during that suicidal crisis, they will never be in that situation again. And I find a lot of hope in that.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. So it's it becomes the bridge that someone thinks about ending their life from. And the examination of their own crisis in that circumstance gives them some of their own tools of reflection to make sure it never happens again.
I think it does. I think you're talking about resiliency. When somebody gets through something like that and comes to the other side of it, that's a difficult experience. And I think we do develop resiliency through our difficult challenges and experiences, and it helps us get through the next one.
Yeah.
What brought about this having you on the program this week was the fact that the Suicide Prevention Council has put together a plan that you want feedback about. So we probably ought to discuss how people can give feedback, but give me an idea of, is this a new plan? Is this the first plan? Is this a revised plan? And if it's a revised plan that you've made improvements on, what are the trends that you are seeing in the tools that are available to both mental health professionals and the community to further address this?
Sure. This will be the first strategic plan for suicide prevention in San Luis Obispo County.
Okay.
And California released their updated plan in 2020. And so based off of that, we created a plan that works for our county, but that still meets the measures that the state is requesting that our county also does to align with their strategic plan. There's four main strategic aims, and the plan is very approachable. It has a lot of resources, has warning signs. It has, you know, support for the reader as well. And so we really did want to make this a community focused plan, because it will take the community, both public and private sectors, community members, really anyone you can think of, to participate in this if we want to optimize its implementation.
And how can people review it? Well, you'd like feedback, but I'm assuming people who want to review it and just know what it says now, it's available for anybody to. So you're not just asking for feedback about suicide. You're asking for people to be able to actually have the ability to review this plan and give their input. For some people, that may mean, I just want to see the plan and get some understanding of what you're doing.
Yes.
So how do people go about seeing that?
You know, Fred, I'm so glad that you asked that. If they go to the county government website and you go to the Behavioral Health Department, the plan is there. And you can also just do a quick Google search for slow suicide prevention or slow county strategic plan for suicide prevention. Any of those keywords will take you to the plan. And you read through, and then there's a survey link on that page where you can leave your comments and provide that feedback we're looking for. And that is available. It's open now for public comment through April 21st.
Okay. Actually, Megan, you had found another link also that I think that by Google that people could find it too, that was slightly different.
I did. Let's see. I looked up San Luis Obispo suicide prevention. And it comes up pretty easily with that, those search terms.
I have a question from a listener that came in by email. What role do you think insurance companies play in suicide statistics in our county? For example, I've been extremely suicidal and I see a team of therapists, case managers, and psychiatrists. After spending a week in a suicide watch in a hospital, and then there became the listener goes on to explain that there were incredibly expenses involved. Mm-hmm. So how her insurance company addressed or considered her condition affected what they would or would not pay for. So I don't know if there's an answer for that.
There are barriers to seeking help and receiving that. Megan, it also, sorry, it looked like you were going to say something.
That's okay. That's always tricky on Zoom, isn't it?
I know.
I was thinking that certainly can be a barrier to care. I know in our county, we see a lot of folks wind up being hospitalized out of county. And then that makes for a difficult transition back to your own county and having a good connection back to your own providers. I think there are some resources in our community that are available free of charge. Our crisis line is one of those services, the Central Coast Hotline. So I'd really encourage anybody who's struggling in the moment to reach out and get support in the moment. There's chat available as well. There's our local hotline offers chat for a few hours Monday through Friday. And then there's a national crisis text line as well. So there are some resources that are available 24/7. For somebody who's in need. But that insurance piece is tricky. It's, we never like to see service limits or session limits impact the quality of somebody's care.
And the idea is that insurance supports mental health or suicide crisis similar to what they would for physical health. And so, it might be that there needs to be an advocate involved. And my heart goes out to you, listener, and thank you for sharing your story with us. There's also the Crisis Stabilization Unit in San Luis Obispo County. And that's a voluntary 23-hour sit-in stay. And so if there's ever that moment where you don't want to be at the hospital but do feel like you need that extra level of care, you can reach out to the Crisis Stabilization Unit as well.
Alicia, can you explain that in a little more detail? That sounds like a very interesting tool.
It's a wonderful tool. It came about in the county, I believe, in 2017, and it's operated by Sierra Mental Wellness, and the county contracts with them to have exactly that, an extra layer of safety for folks who are experiencing a mental health or suicide crisis, and it's a 23-hour voluntary hold. There are a couple limitations. If there's further health concerns, physical health concerns, you might have to go to the hospital and get checked out before going there. However, it supports folks both with private and public health insurance. And so that's what's really nice is that you can have both of those insurance experiences.
Yeah. Our producer just sent me a note and let me know that the link to the plan will be either is already there or will be on the KCBX website for Voices. So when this program is on the website, people can always go straight there and get a link to this also. And that'll be a factor. We're going to take a quick break, let people catch their breath. We'll be back to talk some more. Want to remind you all, this is Central Coast Voices, and you can still call in with questions or concerns at 805-549-8855. email at voices@kcbx.org. We're going to turn it over to Brad in the studio for a bit, and we'll be back with you in a moment. Thank you very much for listening to Central Coast Voices.
And we'll return to Central Coast Voices in just a moment. Brad Kyle here, and I'd like to invite you to become a new member of KCBX by making a donation today. If you contribute by midnight on April 2nd, we'll automatically enter you into a $500 Visa gift card sweepstakes drawing. Support the kind of programming that you depend on, just like Central Coast Voices. Make your first gift online at kcbx.org or call 800-549-8855 during business hours. Donations are not required to enter our drawing, and contest rules are available on our website. And once again, we'd like to thank you for joining us today on KCBX. This afternoon, you can hear Latino USA coming up at 2, followed by Fresh Air at 3 and Marketplace at 4, the kind of programming you depend on from KCBX. Right now, Central Coast Voices continues here on Public Radio KCBX.
Welcome back to Central Coast Voices. I want to thank you for joining us today. This is a serious topic, and thank you for sticking with us. We're talking about preventing suicides in San Luis Obispo County. My guests are from the Suicide Prevention Program at the County Mental Health and also from Transitions Mental Health. Megan Boaz Alvarez is a licensed marriage and family therapist and clinical director for Transitions Mental Health Association. Alicia Hendry is the Suicide Prevention Coordinator with the County of San Luis Obispo Behavioral Health Department. This is a topic that that nobody has fun talking about, but doggone it, we live in a society where we're in this together, and the more we talk about this kind of thing, the more we make sure that our friends and family are safe. Megan, before we get back into any other topic, I would like you to revisit something that I don't want to sound like I'm harping on it, but it was so distressing to hear. I think I want to make sure that people don't forget about it. And that was the issue of suicide in our young people.
Sure. We had shared earlier that suicide is the second leading cause of death for individuals aged 10 to 34. So a significant portion of our population, that's the cause of death, only second to accidents, I believe, is the first cause of death. So that's pretty significant when we think about suicide in a public health context in terms of why are we taking an hour of your time in the middle of the day to talk about this? Well, because it's a public health issue. That's a lot of people who are dying by something that we see as preventable with education and public health campaigning.
The age range you're talking about is as young as 10 years of age. So we are talking about people who are at a point in their life of growth and understanding and of awe of the universe, if you will, that are for some reason feeling isolation, desperation, a number of possibilities that are leading to suicide in an age group that it's distressing to hear about, but we need to be honest.
It is. It's hard to think about. And I appreciate that you said isolation and desperation, because I think those are two things that stand out as being possible flags for indicating that somebody's in trouble. That sense of hopelessness is one thing that we look for when we're trying to assess for risk of suicide. And then isolation, I want to look at the flip side of that. Connection is really a lot of our work in prevention is helping people feel connected, supported, knowing that they're cared about. So having that sense of connection is really key in prevention work. And that's something, what's encouraging about that is that's something that any of us can do, right? We can reach out and make an effort to connect with somebody we're worried about And that's one of the best things we can do to try to support that person and maybe reduce their risk.
Yeah, Megan, I'm glad you brought up connection, because folks can be surrounded by friends or family. They can be surrounded by people. And so it may not seem as though an individual is isolated, but isolation is an individual feeling and experience. And so that's why that connection piece is so important here.
One of the things that has come out, and this is, so I want to preface this in the front with, this is a layman's view of a topic without any professional experience or educational knowledge, if you will. What has come to the top of the discussion in a lot of circles about mental health issues and issues that I would think are in the same category with suicide is that we as individuals and fellow travelers with our friends and family work often to try and be sympathetic. And we're learning more now that being empathetic seems to be a better support mechanism. I don't need to just be worried about you. I need to be able to identify with what your worry is if I'm going to have a conversation with you about it. So you don't need to hear my sympathy. You need to hear how I identify with an understanding of some of the same problems. And that may be a complete obliteration of a real reasonable way of explaining those two balances. I'm hoping maybe the two of you can save me here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for anyone listening, if this is the first time you've really heard that empathy versus sympathy being distinguished, I would look up online Brené Brown, Empathy versus Sympathy. She has a really great video. And it really, you know, the difference is, you know, if you're being sympathetic, you're kind of feeling bad for someone. You might experience pity for them, for example. Whereas being empathetic is saying, you know, I don't know exactly how you feel, but I've been through something difficult in my life and I know how that felt. And if you're feeling anything of that right now, you know, I'm feeling with you. I'm not feeling for you, for example.
Okay. You outed my best understanding about empathy versus sympathy. That
it's a
I've
great
learned
understanding.
This year. It's an incredible video. It is interesting, informative, and engaging. And it conveys in very simply understandable ways how we spend too much time sometimes being sympathetic and not knowing how to be empathetic, when that's often the hand that people need.
Well, and at the end of that video, Brené Brown says, what people really want at the end of the day is connection. So we circle back around to what Megan was just talking about.
Yeah. Thank you. It's a great video. She's done a number of incredible things from that standpoint. We've talked a lot about the fact that suicide is preventable. So I guess maybe, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about it and give people a primer on this. We can remind you that the plan that the county has come up with, Christina, our producer, advised me that it will be linked on the KCBX Central Coast Voices website for you to actually link to the report if you'd like to review it and give some feedback about it. If I'm trying to go walk away with some extra sense of hope and promise for the society we live in and the people around me, what do I need to better understand about simple things or direct things I can do with people in my life to pay attention to whether or not someone is putting a flag up that I haven't noticed?
I think asking real questions is one thing that comes to mind. Instead of saying, how are you? Fine. I'm fine too. And kind of moving on from there. Asking more genuine questions, even in casual interactions. I find myself asking people, how's your day going so far? And I get a different answer than when I just say, how's it going? Mm-hmm. And people tend to tell me a little bit more. And so I use that in casual interactions, but in interactions with friends and family, I guess I know to look for things. So that's something that's helpful for me. But if you're not sure what to look for, I think change is something to look for. If somebody's mood seems to have changed, if they aren't as talkative as they usually are, if you see them at church all the time and they've stopped coming, well, it's hard to assess right now when we've stopped going everywhere. But those are some of the things we look for. People who've stopped participating in the things that they used to enjoy, ask questions about that. I haven't seen you out on the golf course. Are you doing okay? I've missed seeing you.
Yeah, I am. And realistically, in a lot of cases, I haven't seen you for the last couple of weeks at our weekly Zoom gathering. And those have come up too. Brad sure. indicated that we have a caller that had a question. Brad, what do you have to share with us?
Well, we received a message from Blake of San Luis Obispo. He shared that his experience with reaching out when feeling suicidal last year led to police coming to his home and being dropped at the ER, then admission to the hospital. He says that the hospital was the worst experience of his life, and he doesn't think he would call for help again.
Blake, I so appreciate that you reached out and shared your experience with us. I will say this is a conversation that as clinicians we have all the time, and we look at how do we provide the right support for folks when they're in crisis. I think saying up front, I don't want to go to the hospital, I just want to talk with somebody about what's happening is really key if you're the caller who's in distress. And I think for friends and family and professionals who are wanting to help, slowing down and letting the person talk about what they're experiencing is the most important thing that we can do. And most people just need that space to talk about this weight that they're carrying, this distress that they're feeling. And some relief takes place even in that conversation. And by the time that process happens, it may be that an appointment with a therapist is the right follow-up and not hospitalization. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that comes to mind when I hear that outcome, and I do see that outcome frequently, is slow way, way down so we can avoid an outcome like that when it's possible.
Yeah, and also maybe potentially identify an acquaintance, a friend, a family member, someone that you can talk to now and say like, hey, if I'm experiencing this in the future, would it be okay to reach out to you and just talk through what my thoughts are? And that way you have a safe space to express your feelings and thoughts. And like Megan said, sometimes just getting that out helps to diffuse maybe that crisis or prevents that crisis from happening. So thank you for sharing your experience. We definitely take that into account in writing the strategic plan about the type of support that is received post-call.
That also brings up a topic that we've heard this year or over the last year with some of the concern about people's perception that law enforcement is too severe in a lot of crises. And that is the suggestion's been made that it's not so much that they need to cut back. We need to cut back on law enforcement. We need to have mental health professionals and community professionals more in aligned with and part of the policing process, if you will. So, the caller, it occurred to me that if there was some way for law enforcement to have an intervention counselor available or in that kind of environment where that person is coming and talking with the person in crisis where they are versus displacing them and putting them in a hospital or even sending them to somebody's clinical office might be in and of itself the most disruptive part of this.
Yeah, and steps are being made towards that direction. We do have a mental health evaluation team in the county. And so maybe rather than calling, law enforcement, the mental health evaluation team can respond. And then also for the caller, we brought up the crisis stabilization unit earlier. So maybe that, if you are experiencing those feelings again, you can call we call it the CSU, the Crisis Stabilization Unit. Try giving them a call, and see if that is a nice, appropriate way to find that support that you need as well.
So is that listed on the county's mental health department page, or how do you find that particular department?
Fred, you are just asking all the great questions. It is indeed on the county mental health behavioral health page. You can type in Crisis Stabilization Unit into Google, and it will also appear there as well.
On the prior to the program starting today, I mentioned one of my personal frustrations, which was the fact that the phone number for hotline is not an easy to remember number. And Megan mentioned radio or television commercials that Transitions Mental Health is running now to solve that. So rather than me solving it, why don't you explain what it is?
I'd be glad to talk about that. So we do have a campaign running right now reminding folks to put the hotline number into their phone. That is a great thing to do when you are not in crisis, because who wants to try to remember all of those digits? It's like 10 digits when you're in crisis, right? So what we recommend is that you put the hotline number into your phone right now while you're, just in case you need it. That way, if you need to call for a friend or a family member or yourself, you'll already have that number.
I suspect you're going to give us the phone number, right?
I was thinking I would, Fred. It is an 800 number. So it's 1-800-783-0607. It takes about 8 seconds to pop that into your phone, and then you'll have it handy if you need to call for a friend or family member or for yourself. And I would always encourage anyone to reach out to the hotline. We've got folks there 24/7 who are trained to offer support. You don't have to know what to do. You just have to know who to call and ask for some support.
Yeah. And in defense of the people who run hotline, it's not your fault that the number is not easy to remember. It's very difficult to get 800 numbers that are easy to remember. You did mention to me that there's some program being looked at to actually have hotline numbers to be a 3-digit emergency number. We probably shouldn't give that number that we believe it will become out, because people will be believe it's available now. It's not. But can you explain that program
sure.
a little better?
Yeah, I appreciate the caution, because I've seen in writing that it was available and it's not. It won't go live until June of 2022. So, of course, we're still a ways out from that. But the FCC passed a motion, a law, whatever the FCC passes that agreed to do this. Congress has agreed as well. It's not quite yet funded, but there is a plan to have a 3-digit number for mental health crisis, like we do for a physical health emergency, that would network to the National Suicide Prevention Centers. So it's coming, but not active yet.
Which is very exciting. As Megan said, in a crisis, remembering a 10-digit number is a lot more difficult. I will say that, and hopefully people use that and utilize it, right? But that means that more people will. And so if you're listening and you want to know how to be more involved, consider, if you have the time and ability and bandwidth in your life, potentially volunteering for the hotline in the future. If you're like, how can I get involved? You know, I want to support this. That's a way that you can support your community. And, you know, of course, you're helping folks, so I'm sure there's some sense of involvement there as well for you. So just keeping in mind that with that number, we're going to need more support in the future.
That is true. I appreciate you putting that opportunity out there. We're looking for folks who want to volunteer on our text line as well as the crisis hotline. And the other thing I'd like to add is, I think people get nervous when they think about volunteering on a suicide hotline and think that maybe that would be scary work to do. And I would like to share that in my experience, it has been the opposite, because people who call a suicide hotline want help from someone. And people who work on a suicide hotline would like to help. So at the outset of that call, people are pretty aligned, and usually the outcomes are positive outcomes. So that's one thing I like to say to decrease any anxiety about signing up for that kind of work.
And you go through a very nice amount of training to prepare you and equip you with the tools you'll need as well.
There is a lot of training.
Yeah. And the hotline in our county is not just for suicide prevention. It's, you can pretty much call it for anything that you can't, that you need help with, that you can't get information for, that's non-commercial, if you will. There's access to a lot of resources. People who the hotline, I know, has even done things like provide people who feel stranded because they don't understand public transportation, the resources of who they can call. I suspect the directory that hotline has of the other numbers they can send people to is a key element of what you work with in that organization.
Definitely a robust list of resources and hotlines available for anybody in any kind of mental health crisis or even looking for mental health resources in the community.
Yeah. A recurring theme that I see in the materials that you shared with me to understand this also is that we are doing no one a favor if we keep the concept of and discussions of suicide a secret in our family. The fact that you've talked about the number of factors of suicide in young people means that that it may not be something that ever got discussed in their household that gave them the tools to even think about reaching out for help. So keeping the discussion of suicide or fear of suicide a secret does no one a favor, I guess.
I think it adds potentially to the stigma by just not talking about it. And we, of course, have to respect different cultures and their boundaries and experience and understanding of suicide. But if we're approaching this from a public health lens, then we indeed, you know, need to integrate this into our lives and talk about maybe a famous individual who died by suicide as a starter of a conversation, or if a friend, for example. So it looks like we have a phone call, so I'm going to stop talking.
Okay, go ahead. Yes.
Thank you very much, Fred. A doctor in our community who practiced for decades said he never had a suicide in his care. He says the number one reason for his experience was his practice of being direct with patients. Have you been having or had suicidal thoughts, he asks. If there was any indication that the patient would be referred to a mental health specialist, he adds that in 2022 there would be a three-digit number to call nationwide.
Yeah, wonderful snaps to that physician, because we highly encourage in all of our trainings to be direct when asking about suicide, when you notice those signs and symptoms. So gold standard for that physician. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the gold standard, is to ask clearly and directly, to notice that something is happening and ask about it. And it's only by asking the question do we realize, okay, this person needs to be linked to more help.
And your general practitioner is often a great start. You tend to have a regular relationship if you've been seeing them over the years. And so you might feel more comfortable. There might be more trust there to start the conversation about what you're thinking about, the suicidal experience, if you're having mental health challenges. And then that physician can then further refer out to a mental health professional, maybe rule out some physical ailments if that is contributing to the challenges. But that is part of what we like to talk about when we talk about suicide prevention as well.
Yeah. We are down to the last few minutes, and as my regular listeners know, I do my best to get out of the way so my guests get to have the last word. I do need to exit the program at the end of the day, but the two of you may have some things that you want to make sure that don't get lost in this discussion. To an emailer that we just got a couple of minutes ago, your email is somewhat intricate, and I will pass it on to our guests. We don't have the ability to really cover it on the program right now, but I will pass it along. Megan, I'll start with you. What do you want to make sure that that people walk away with the knowledge of after listening to us talk today?
Well, really just the idea that they can be a resource for somebody they care about who is at risk, that by just noticing the change or a change or something different in this person that they care about and asking that person, hey, what's going on? I'm wondering if you're okay. That is enough to open the door to the conversation. You know, when people are connected with in a genuine way, they often open up and share what's been happening. And you don't have to know what to do or how to help that person. You just have to be able to sit there and listen. And Fred, I'll go back to that concept of empathy that you mentioned a while ago. To be willing to be present with that person while they sit in their pain and hear a little bit about that and express some understanding, and then talk with them about, you know, I think maybe we should get you some help for this. That sounds really painful. That sounds really difficult. And I'd like to see you get some help for yourself. I think knowing that any one of us can be that resource, can be the person who notices, who asks the question, who checks in with someone, and that's really what suicide prevention looks like.
It sounds like one of the things you're also adding to the mix is just asking people, what can I do for you now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good to hear. Thank you. Alicia.
Fred, so many things to say right now. One, the Suicide Prevention Strategic Plan is really meant for the community. And I really encourage everyone listening today to read through it. See where you fit in here. Is that just increasing your knowledge? Is that understanding the warning signs? Is that learning what our local resources look like? You know, step one. Step two, there are a lot of agencies working towards supporting our community as it is. So we are out there helping folks, but it does take a holistic view of everything involved, whether that's community members, the beer, wine, cannabis industry here locally, restaurants, you know, every part of society really has a slight role to play. And so, you know, read through the plan and see where that role is for you. And please leave us comments. We want to hear from you. And then finally, for those out here listening who have thoughts of suicide, maybe you've had an attempt in the past. I just want you to know that this is why I do this work, is for you. Your story, your experience can really help others in the future support through their own experience. We want you to thrive. We want you to feel good. And we're here and we're doing this for you. So just know that you're not alone. Know that you are seen and you are heard, and that, you know, we're working to support your wellness. So thanks for tuning in today.
Thank you to both of you. I do have one thought that we didn't mention, and that is there a cutoff of time as to how long people can provide feedback for this new plan? It's easy to not know how long I can think about this.
Of course, yeah. And I'm a last minute person myself, so I get that. April 21st is the last day for public comment. This plan will be revised on a probably 3 to 5 year basis. So you'll have other opportunities. You have an opportunity to join the Suicide Prevention Strategic. Oh my gosh, I keep calling it that. The Suicide Prevention Council of San Luis Obispo. So if you miss the cutoff, which we hope that you don't, but if you do, there are other ways to continue your involvement.
And we'll leave it with that. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you to both of you. I want to remind you that next week, Chris Kington Barker will be back in this chair, and she and I switch every other week, which works out really fine for us. She is going to be talking with the creators of a project called Voices of the Earth. This is a project that brings together some of the greatest environmental voices, past and present, to examine the troubled relationship between humanity and the natural world, which surrounds all of us. Her guests are from Stanford University and the Henry Miller Memorial Library in Big Sur, and they will give you a preview of this inspiring project. It's a call to action for how we as human beings work with the earth that we get to live on and keep it alive and together. Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with KCBX. The program is underwritten by our friend Joan Gellert Sargent. You can leave your feedback at voices@kcbx.org. We appreciate the support and the collaboration we have with KCBX Public Radio. Thank you to Brad Kyle, our in-studio engineer today. And thank you to my guests, Alicia Hendry and Megan Boaz Alvarez. This has been an important topic. I hope you've learned something from this, and I hope you can better connect with the family and friends around you to make sure that suicide is something that is not prevalent in the community that you are part of. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for tuning in to Central Coast Voices. This show will be available to listen to later today on our website, kcbx.org. You can hear any of our local shows anytime and stream on demand from kcbx.org. And find us on social media at kcbxfm.